This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Carl Zimmer has received high praise for his writing on science. The New York Times Book Review calls him as fine a science essayist as we have. Scientific American says his book, Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea, is as fine a book as one will find on the subject. And his book, Soul Made Flesh, A History of the Brain, was dubbed a tour de force by the Sunday Telegraph. But all of this praise, as gratifying as it is, would be far less meaningful were it not for the simple fact that Carl Zimmer has a remarkable facility for being able to take complex scientific concepts and discoveries and make them understandable to average people. He makes science approachable, and in a world that is literally controlled by the products of science, that is truly important. But he has accepted our invitation to share some of his scientific knowledge this hour. He's in our studio. Welcome to Charlotte, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You have written a lot about evolution, and you wrote a textbook called The Tangled Bank, which has been described as the best written and illustrated introduction to evolution and the most conversant with ongoing research. But you're speaking tonight, I believe, about the human genome.
Well, this afternoon I will be on a panel talking about the human genome and all the advances that we've had. And then this evening I will be taking a kind of different look at human nature. I'll be looking at all the microbes that share our bodies with us.
Which I want to talk about because it's creepy.
Very.
But this human genome, if more people understood that, because so few, there are a lot of people who don't believe in evolution. If they understood the genome, would that help them understand or believe in evolution?
Well, the genome is really an archive, an historical archive that records our evolution. You can actually go in there and you can see how we have lots of genetic sequences that are nearly identical with our closest living relatives, which are chimpanzees. Then you can see some other stretches of DNA we share with chimpanzees and gorillas. They're sort of like our first and second cousins, as it were. It's all in there. And now that scientists can sequence human genomes so easily, we're getting to see our evolutionary history in finer and finer detail. We can even see the stretches of DNA in living humans that came from Neanderthals.
Is that because we share some elements in our genome with chimpanzees and gorillas? Is that indicative of the fact that we were once chimpanzees and gorillas or their antecedents? Or is it simply that we share some pieces of information that allow us to be upright and mammals?
We share a common ancestor with chimpanzees and gorillas that lived about 10 million years ago. It was probably a sort of a medium-sized ape, spent a lot of time in the trees, didn't have a tail, had a small brain, and was living somewhere in Africa. I mean, we know these things based on...
How do we know that?
Well, based on looking at DNA from these different species and looking at fossils, looking at the living species, and sort of weaving all that evidence together. You get independent lines of evidence that support each other to give you a picture of what life was like back then. So, you know, we did not evolve from chimpanzees, just like, you know, you do not descend from your first cousin. You share a common ancestor.
That's very difficult to understand. At least it is for me. You obviously do. You understand this.
Well, I think that, you know, it's the basics of evolution are pretty straightforward. It's just can be kind of strange to think about. I mean, the fact that we can track our evolution not just back to our ape ancestors, but to our early mammal ancestors, to our microbial ancestors, just by looking at the genome, is pretty remarkable. Hmm. But that information is in there.
They have now sequenced the human genome, and it took them years to do it and a lot of money to do more than slightly less than the personal fortunes of Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, but it cost billions of dollars.
About $3 billion.
Now, they can do this in a couple of weeks for a couple of grand. How have we moved so quickly and decreased the cost so precipitously?
Well, the U.S. government really played a big role in this. They set up the Human Genome Project throughout much of the 1990s, there was this big push to get one human genome sequenced. In other words, all the DNA to make a person. And once they sort of mapped out all those genes, in the human genome, then they said, okay, what can we do to speed this process up? And they would support scientists at universities. They would support small companies that were coming up with innovative ways to do a better job of sequencing DNA using radically new methods and just trying them out to see if they worked. And they would work. And so actually, the advances in sequencing DNA have gone much faster and much further than the advances with our computers. So maybe you heard of Moore's Law where, you know,
every 7 years.
Yeah, DNA sequencing blows Moore's Law away.
Really? Mm-hmm. Moore's Law is that every 7 years, the power of a computer will double.
Yeah.
And so far, it's proven to be true.
That's right.
Is it safe to say that the sequencing of a person's DNA, is that the book of his or her life, or is it a chapter in the book of life because we're just individuals?
I would say that it's can be really helpful to understand someone, but it's not everything. Just on one very simple biological level, if you look at that list of genes, well, you know, those genes only matter if they're actually making proteins in your body. And actually, you have little ways of switching on and off those genes. People may have different patterns of those switches. And so you and I might have the same gene, and yours might be switched off and mine might be switched on. Hmm. So even though we have the same genes, we're using them differently.
And what determines that?
A lot of different things. Everything from your mother's experience while she was pregnant with you, to the food that you ate as a child, to your psychological experiences. This is a whole fascinating field called epigenetics. Mm-hmm. Scientists are just starting to understand how that influences how the genome works.
So, so many things influence who we become and who we are in terms of how our personalities form, what we can do physically, because some of us have talents that others of us don't, et cetera. When you sequence a person's genome, and they can now do this for all of us very quickly and relatively cheaply, what does that give us? What do we then know about ourselves that we didn't know before? How does it benefit us?
It's a starting off point, I look at it as. In other words, you can get your genome sequenced, as you said, for a few thousand dollars, but then you need to find somebody who could interpret it for you. Mm-hmm. And they might say, well, okay, that part of your genome tells me that you are of, let's say, European descent, which you might have already known. You know, so sometimes it's kind of telling you what you already knew. But there might be things that you didn't know about. For example, you might not know that you had a risk for a certain type of disease that doesn't emerge until later in life. Scientists are starting to be able to make some predictions along those lines. It's still very rough. The real value in sequencing people's genomes is that you can sequence a lot of people's genomes and look at them all, and basically say, okay, here's 1,000 or 100,000 genomes. And not only that, but I also have their medical history. Now, if I look around, is there any particular little mutation that is linked to some particular disease? Mm-hmm. That's when important clues start to emerge.
That's not something a family physician could do. That's something a scientist who specializes in genomics would have to be involved in, correct?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I do think that maybe in 10 years, mm-hmm. That your genome will be part of what your family doctor looks at with some help from some very powerful computers. Mm-hmm. But we're not there yet. I mean, there are a few cases where people have had very mysterious diseases, you know, children who are dying of inexplicable diseases. And their doctors have had their genome sequenced, and they've been able to pinpoint the mutation that gave them that disease that no one knew about before. But it's very, very special cases right
now. A couple of years ago, a company that you work for, a publication you work for, National Geographic, was doing a project where they would take, genetic samples. You would do a little cotton swab in your cheek and send it off to them. And I did this because they were on the program. And they would send you back information about where you came from. Your ancestry. And of course, mine starts in Africa because all of ours start in Africa. But they actually showed you the migration somehow. I don't know how they did this, from Africa up through the northern part of Europe and into the British Isles, which I'm Irish. So obviously, they're right. They didn't know who I was. They didn't know my name. I'm just a number to them. It's fascinating. They could do that. How could they do that?
Well, that's the amazing thing that scientists started discovering in the 1980s, is that the emergence of humanity from where it started in East Africa is inscribed in our genomes. And the reason being that every now and then, over the generations, a mutation pops up, and then someone will pass that mutation down to their descendants. So if a mutation pops up in a group of people who have just emerged from Africa into the Middle East, the people back in Africa don't have that mutation. And so that now serves as a marker for all the people who came out of Africa. Mm-hmm. So you have certain markers that you share in common with people in China, because you all descend from these people who moved out of Africa and spread out to the rest of the old world. But then some of you, then your ancestors are branched off and headed west, and they picked up more mutations that the people in China never got. So you have this string of markers in your genome that show us how your ancestors came from Africa to Ireland.
Given that the science of genomics is moving faster than Moore's Law, are we prepared in a couple of years, as you said, it may be possible for a doctor to look at your genome or your genetic map and know more things about you than he does now, and be able to actually, we'll get into this, tailor some medical treatments to you because of that. Is the science way ahead of the ethics and the morals of all this? Are we prepared in our brains for what we're going to learn about ourselves and how it's going to be used?
There are some big ethical questions that are coming up. So let's say, for example, parents have a baby and the baby's genome is sequenced at birth. Let's say that that's sort of what doctors did. So now that baby has its whole genome there.
Could you do it before birth?
Yeah, you could.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a whole extra other can of worms. But let's just say that you know you have your baby's genome, mm-hmm. and do you want to look at it? I mean, do you want to know that baby who looks totally healthy right now in 30 years may develop, has a serious risk for some horrendous disease, or, you know, at age 60 is going to get Alzheimer's? Do you want that hanging over you? Do you want that hanging over your child? Or do you want to be prepared with knowledge? Those are the questions we're going to have to come to terms with.
Is the information that we get from knowing this just going to be about our physical health? Would it also tell us perhaps our predisposition to being able to be an athlete or a musician or have a scientific bent? Or will it tell us intellectual things or talents or proclivities that we may want to select out for?
I don't think it's going to tell you that your kid's going to become a lawyer or something like that. The genome is just a set of genes, and genes don't really do anything unless they're interacting with the outside world, with school, with all these sort of much more intangible things. There's been a lot of hoopla recently about how Chinese researchers are doing a big project to look for intelligence genes. Mm-hmm. They'll find a lot of intelligence genes, each of which has a tiny effect.
So there's nothing in your genetic makeup that makes you a great science writer?
I haven't found it yet.
Okay. Carl Zimmer is with us. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for this archive edition of Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and HealthWorks by Carolina Healthcare System, working with employers to improve health through targeted healthcare programs. It takes a partnership, working together as one. carolinashealthcare.org/healthworks. And Park Sterling Bank, providing financial solutions for personal and business needs. Answers you can bank on. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Details at parksterlingbank.com. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, college preparation is one of the core missions of American high schools, but only 50% of high school graduates will attend a four-year college. What about the other half, the students who can't afford college or for whom a four-year degree is simply not the right path? In a 21st century workplace where skills are paramount, experts are calling for more options for young people, more career-oriented paths in high school. We'll hear about that when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Many say Turkey's direct involvement is critical to the coalition's fight against ISIS, but Turkey is asking for more protection near its border with Syria. Understanding Turkey's role in the region and the militant group's growing reach.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Carl Zimmer, who's a science writer and author of many books, 13 books, and you can read him in the New York Times. You can read him in the, he writes a blog for the National Geographic. You just said off the air that everything you knew about this topic 10 years ago, you can just throw it away because it's all changed. It's moving that fast.
Well, when I look back at some of the books that I wrote a book called Evolution and the Triumph of an Idea in 2001, which was supposed to be kind of a broad overview of what we understood about evolution. A lot of it still remains true, but I never even mentioned a single genome, the human genome, for example, because it hadn't come out yet. Right. And so by looking at the human genome, we've gotten an entirely new look at evolution, a much deeper one than we had before.
We're also finding out, I read this yesterday because of you, we're also finding out that what we think we know about the use of DNA in crimes may not be true, that people can have two different kinds of markers. In other words, if you get a saliva sample, it might lead you to believe that's you, and then there'll be a semen sample, and that's got different markers in it, so it would not look like the same person. So the CSI stuff that we're seeing on television is not true. There's more to it than that.
There is more to it. And the CSI people, the forensic people, know that more than anyone else. So they have to be on their guard about this very interesting part of biology, which is that a surprising number of people are actually two people. In the sense that instead of starting off with a single genome, they started off with two separate genomes. They might have basically been twins that fused together in the womb, for example. If you get a bone marrow transplant, basically you're getting cells from somebody else with a different genome in it, and then they start to actually mix with your own cells.
So and what's the implication of that? I mean, do you change in some subtle way?
Well, it's a tricky thing because these different genomes have to get along. Otherwise you're going to be kind of sick. And actually, for women,
is that why they tissue type?
Definitely. I mean, definitely, if you're going to get a donation, you want to make sure that it's a matching type.
But is that what's going on? Even before we knew about the human genome, that was what was going on, that the fact that the two genomes will fight each other if they're not compatible.
Yeah, we had a very kind of dim understanding of this. Mm-hmm. We knew that different cells from different people might have different little receptors on their surface, and that might trigger different things in people's bodies. So you wanted to be careful that you had sort of matching tissue types with a donation. Mm-hmm. But we're talking this just happens all the time. So with women, for example, when women have children, they tend to hold on to some of their children's cells after birth. These cells kind of start to become part of their own body. And so there was a study done recently where scientists did autopsies on women who had died and looked in their brains at their cells. And they were using these very sensitive techniques to look at the gene content of them. And they would find cells in their brains with Y chromosomes. Y chromosomes being what defines males. These were the Y chromosomes from their sons that had been wandering around in their body in their son's cells, and it ended up in their brains. So many women are what we call chimeras. They just don't know it.
So what does that mean? I mean, what does that do to them over time?
So some scientists are looking at whether there may be some diseases that could be connected with being a chimera. Is your immune system kind of responding to these other cells and maybe causing inflammation, which can cause some harmful side effects? Some people have actually suggested that this might be a good thing, that it actually helps to regulate people's bodies and reduce the odds of certain kinds of diseases. So it might be good to be a chimera.
We just don't know yet.
They're just starting to use these really sensitive techniques to figure out who's a chimera and who isn't.
And does this only happen with childbirth? And does it happen to if it happens to men, does it only happen in utero?
So if a man is a chimera, he became a chimera in his mother's womb because his embryo combined with another embryo.
I see.
And you can, and what's interesting is like different tissues will belong to one of those people or the other. So, you know, the skin might belong to one of the embryos and the heart would belong to the other embryo. And actually, you know, there was a woman who, it was a famous case where a woman needed to have a transplant. And so they did some typing of her and her children, hoping to find one to be a good match. And they said, these are not your children. And she said, well, I was there when they were born.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, we're looking at their genes. They're not your children. And the problem was that they had been comparing one of her genomes to her children's genomes. And it was the wrong genome. They should have been looking at different tissues for a different genome. She looked like a totally different person.
And you understand all this.
This is just biology. Totally. It's
now,
biology. I mean, every day I'm reading something and I kind of rub my eyes and say, wait, what?
Uh-huh. Which is why you like this.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. This whole ability to look at the human genome is going to give rise to personalized medicine, the development of drugs specifically for you, for the condition that you have. If you have two genomes, how do you know which to make the medicine for?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, and you, we're going to have to get to know not just our personal genome, but our personal genomes. You know, even after you're born and your cells are dividing, a cell may mutate, and that may create a whole line of cells in your body that have some genetic difference from the rest of the cells. Mm. And you may need to understand that in order to treat someone.
And we always hear about the rising cost of medicine. Is this going to make the costs of medicine rise even more? Will there be money in it for drug companies to make a medicine for me and another one for you and another one for our producers and another one for one of our listeners? I mean, for the same condition?
So that is a really good and important question, and I don't think we know the answer to it. But I will say that when people talk about personalized medicine, they're not necessarily just talking about inventing a medicine from scratch just for you. What they're talking about is looking at all the medicines that have already been approved for all sorts of diseases and say, and just drawing up a cocktail that would be special to you. So a person might be diagnosed with cancer, and when they look at the mutations in the tumor, they might say, you know what? We could target that defective protein with a drug that we've been using for 50 years for inflammation that has nothing to do with cancer, but we think it's going to target this key mutation in this cancer that this one person has. So it would be more about just, you know, going and, you know, like think of a pharmacist going back to all those drugs and just sort of plucking ones off the shelf. They'll pluck a special combination just for you.
You know, we've all read or seen the movie Jurassic Park. And that's one of the things that most people are most familiar about when we talk about genes, and particularly about DNA. And there was an article in the New York Times Sunday magazine a couple of Sundays ago about resurrecting. The cover of the magazine had a big woolly mammoth on it. And I thought, well, this is going to be interesting. It's going to be about resurrecting the woolly mammoth. But it really wasn't about that. It was really about resurrecting the passenger pigeon, because that's easier to do. And actually, they think it can be done. We can bring back, do you think, extinct species? And if we can, should we?
So this is a really fascinating area that I've been covering for a while. Last year, I wrote a cover story in National Geographic about what we call de-extinction. And I based that story on a meeting I went to in Washington, where a bunch of these scientists got together to talk about this possibility. And, you know, by the end of the meeting, you had experts on the genome and, you know, paleontologists and all the rest. And at the end of the meeting, they looked around at each other and said, I think we might be able to do this. And it was kind of a spooky realization.
But then you have to think about things like the environment. The environment has changed since the woolly mammoth has been here. There are opportunistic diseases that perhaps they would have no immunity toward because it's a different world.
Mm-hmm.
They could hurt us, it seems to me, by their mere existence because the world wasn't designed for us when they were around. We do have to think about it. Is the risk of playing God, essentially, by bringing these species back, worth it?
Well, when people talk about playing God by bringing species back, I point out that we have driven many species extinct.
Well, aren't we completely responsible for most of it?
if people are worried about us playing God, then, I think that, the horse is out of the barn. I mean, we've already been driving species extinct. We've been driving evolution already. So maybe we should just be more responsible in how we manage evolution.
It's probably unlikely that we'll bring back the woolly mammoth, but let's just
maybe not.
Okay, well, all right. Then let's use that as an example because the woolly mammoth, it would seem to me, would have no predators. There'd be nobody after them.
Mm-hmm.
So because there's no ecosystem like there was an ecosystem to handle them before.
Well, it's not exactly true. I mean, there are, in the Siberian tundra, there are Russian researchers who've set off a large area, they call it Pleistocene Park, and they're bringing in large grazing mammals to basically restore this tundra to more of a grassland the way it was back when there were mammoths around. And so
in preparation for this? Is that why they're doing it?
No, they just say any large grazing mammal that's like what was there before, it will be good for that ecosystem. And so when they've been asked, would you like a woolly mammoth? They say, we'd be happy to have a woolly mammoth.
Mm-hmm.
We have elephants, and it's not like elephants are rampaging down Manhattan. They're not going to turn our world upside down.
Okay.
You'll have some mammoths grazing in Siberia.
You reported in the Times in December that scientists have extracted the entire genome of a 130,000-year-old Neanderthal from a single toe bone. Could we bring back that species?
Not today. But, part of the problem is that, just having a sequence of letters on a page is not the same thing as having an actual biological piece of DNA that's in a cell that is viable. Now, if you could figure that out, if you could figure out how to fold it and cover it with the right kind of molecules and so on and so forth, who knows? Maybe you could do it.
But should we? And would somebody do it? I mean, what would it, if we had the ability to do it, could some, and this is the problem with science today, people don't know enough about science to really understand what goes on and how science is conducted. And all our information about, and we've done a show on this, is why I know this, all of our science, all of our impressions about scientists for the most, in the mass culture, is that of a mad scientist, Dr. Frankenstein, who does something terribly bad, like create this monster, because he's out of control and he wants these ego-driven, etc. Could some scientists, when we have the ability to do this, create a Neanderthal? And what are our responsibilities to that creature?
Well, you'd have to infer what Neanderthals were like. And Neanderthals we're starting to appreciate that Neanderthals were pretty smart. We have this caricature of them as being kind of these lumbering cavemen. A Neanderthal is an insult you hurl at someone.
Right.
But it looks as if they were pretty sophisticated. They may have been able to borrow some tool-making techniques from humans. They may have made some of their own jewelry. They had brains as big as ours. They lived in all sorts of amazing places, rugged places where it's not easy to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So given that, I don't think it would be ethical to bring back a Neanderthal because the Neanderthal is sentient enough that and has not had a choice in the matter. And in this environment, I don't think that that's, we can't predict what it's going to be like for that person.
We'll just give them an iPad. They'll be fine.
let's
we're going to hopscotch around because you write about a lot of different things in the course of a year. And one of the things that you have written about is the zoo within us, the real zoo that we carry around, our own personal ecosystem. When you bring up the fact that we are literally crawling with with stuff, microbes, they're on us, they're in us, and in fact, we have more microbes than we have human cells in our bodies. What's the reaction you get from an audience?
The first reaction is usually a bit of a shudder. because people would prefer not to be aware of this, because we think of germs as being this thing that these things that are out to get us, and some of them are, but most of them aren't. And in fact, we actually depend on our microbes for our well-being.
Is it right that there are 10 times as many non-human cells in our bodies as there are human cells?
It's a rough estimate. It could be maybe 5 times as many, maybe 10. But we are outnumbered.
Is that,
by our microbes.
Is that true of every species that walks the planet or swims in the ocean, not just us?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you have a body, bacteria and viruses and fungi have probably found a way to live inside of you. Because, bodies are great places to live. There's food coming in, they're warm, they're stable. So for a microbe, it's fantastic.
I've often wondered about that. Bodies are great places to live. So if you're a microbe, I know the microbes aren't intelligent, but why would you then go in and kill the host?
Well, there are a lot of different ways of making a living.
Okay. So how have we survived all these creepy crawlies that are on and in us?
We have a nice little, understanding. Basically, our immune system has evolved to tolerate thousands of different species of bacteria. Basically, and it's amazing. I mean, they can say like, okay, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay. You, we're going to attack and we're going to kill. Mm-hmm. And our survival depends on them being able to tell the difference. And actually, when the immune system goes off the rails, one of the problems is it starts to look at the beneficial bacteria as enemies, and then it may even start to attack our own tissues. And so that balance is crucial to our well-being.
How many of these things, how many different kinds of microbes do we have on an average day?
We don't know. We haven't counted them all. The scientists are still a long way from finishing their survey. And some of the species that are on you are not on me. So that adds on to even more complexity. Let's just say thousands. Mm-hmm. Thousands of species.
You mentioned fungi a little while ago. And there are these commercials on television now for toenail fungus. And I'm just wondering, when you have an outbreak of toenail fungus, is that because those organisms have been living in you for years and suddenly something's gone awry and they are allowed to bloom and flourish? Or is this something new that you have picked up in a shower at the gym?
It can be something you picked up, at the gym. Sometimes a species will go from one part of your body to another where it really shouldn't be. And actually, there are these interesting links, say, between the germs in your mouth and heart disease. And so that's why you should, brush and floss, because you got a very complicated ecosystem in your mouth and you don't want any of that getting down to your heart through bleeding gums.
Wow. I want to come back to that. All kinds of questions are going through my mind, but we have to take a break. Carl Zimmer is our guest, science writer and author of many books on science. Charlotte talks.
This is an archive edition of Charlotte Talks, where our support comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Pointer Spruill, celebrating 25 years of serving business clients in Charlotte, with other offices in Raleigh, Rocky Mount, Southern Pines, and Wilmington. Information available at pointerspruill.com. And Aparo, providing corporations with technology-based volunteer opportunities that empower nonprofits to achieve their missions. Aparo's skilled volunteer engagement program, one IT solution, thousands served. Aparo.org. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, many say Turkey's direct involvement is critical to the coalition's fight against ISIS. But Turkey is asking for more protection from coalition forces near its border with Syria. Understanding Turkey's role in the region and the militant group's growing reach on The Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Here on 90.7 WFAE.
Can high school kids learn a trade before they go to college?
What we wanted to do was to create a student who is able to go out into the field, but also college ready.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, the changing world of vocational education. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Carl Zimmer, science writer and author. You can read his work in the pages of the New York Times. He writes a blog for the National Geographic. He has a number of books, including Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea, Soul Made Flesh, which is about the human brain, At the Water's Edge, and Parasite Rex. I guess we're kind of talking about that right now, a little bit, right? I mean,
A little bit.
Let's get back to the mouth flora
Sure. That
we have for a second. Because inflammation of the gums and bleeding gums, which are caused by microorganisms in many cases, can lead to heart disease. That's why dentists tell you to floss and brush on a regular basis. Can you exchange in a kiss, for instance, if you have these bacteria in your mouth that could lead you to have heart disease? Can you exchange them to somebody who's completely healthy in that department, and they then become at risk for this?
Well, we're constantly trading microbes all the time, and it's not just through kissing, it's through shaking hands, it's by handling doorknobs. I mean, like, these microbes are shuttling between us all the time. I mean, that's how we get the flu, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you cannot wall yourself off from microbes. And as a matter of fact, it's not that, you know, all the microbes in your mouth are out to get you.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, most of them are there protecting you. Actually, they create this ecosystem that makes it hard for the bad bugs to get in. They can't penetrate in.
So then when we brush our teeth or use Listerine or something like that, are we not killing off the good stuff?
Well, what you want to do is you don't want to feed the bad bugs. And so if you have a lot of sugar hanging around on your teeth, you're going to be basically, it's like, you know, throwing out bird seed for some birds you don't want around.
You say we think of ourselves as individual human beings, but our identity is actually intermingled with a menagerie of microbes. How do they make up our identity? I mean, are they part of who we are?
Absolutely.
Do they inform who we are? How so?
Well, you know, if you were born without any microbes, and we kept you sealed off in a chamber someplace where they couldn't get to you, you'd be sick and miserable, and you might have some serious mental problems. I mean, that's just what we know about the microbiome through many, many experiments on mostly on mice and seeing what happens when they put microbes in or take them out.
Mm-hmm.
We have this intimate relationship with them, and they do things that we couldn't do with our own cells. We have about 20,000 genes. If you take all of the bacteria and other microbes in our bodies, there might be millions of genes that they've got. And a lot of those genes do things like break down food that we can't break down ourselves, or make vitamins, like vitamin B12. I mean, you can't make vitamin B12. And if you don't have vitamin B12, you will get very sick. They make it.
We also have viruses around us, on us, in us. We know that viruses make us sick. Bacteria makes us sick. But we don't know exactly what viruses are. And in fact, viruses are good for us in some cases, you say. I never knew that before yesterday when I was reading your material. Viruses are good for us?
So we think of viruses as things that make us really sick, like the flu or Ebola. But the fact is, you know, you look like you're quite healthy today. You probably have, roughly speaking, about a quadrillion viruses inside of you right now. And the thing is that most of them are not infecting your cells.
I'm not feeling so good anymore.
I'll give you some time to come to terms with that. But that's a fact, about a quadrillion viruses. And those viruses, they are mostly infecting bacteria. They're specialists on bacteria. So they're going in and infecting the bacteria in your gut.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually regulating the numbers, the populations of those different species. So they're like the predators in an ecosystem.
So, and we don't know exactly what they are. We say they're not a life form, or at least I've heard that they're not a life form, and yet they reproduce. How can they not be a life form? And if they're not, what are they?
Yeah, viruses are amazing. I wrote a book called The Planet of Viruses recently about them. And they're basically, if you look at them, they're a tiny little package usually, you know, protein shell with some genes inside, and that's about it. If you look at our cells or bacteria, they're big cells that are just full of things going on inside of them. There's lots of metabolism. They're feeding, they're growing, they're making waste, they're getting rid of the waste, and so on and so forth. Viruses just are there to deliver genes into a host cell, and then that cell makes new viruses, and that's pretty much their story.
Okay.
So, you know, they don't quite have all of the features that some people think you need to be considered alive.
Okay.
You know, they don't grow. They can't survive on their own.
And some of these viruses are attacking the bacteria, keeping them in check, the bacteria inside of us. We have antibiotics. We've had them for, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years now, and we're running out of them. And they're getting weaker, and the bacteria that they have traditionally been successful at fighting are getting stronger. And so we're coming to the end of this antibiotic era. Is the future of fighting these bad bacteria the culturing of viruses to do the job?
That's one area that people are looking into. Yeah, you know, let's harness these masters of bacterial killing. These viruses. This is a dream that scientists have had for actually over a century, and it's something called phage therapy. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's been tried in one way or another over the years. So, for example,
they use it in Russia.
That's right. In World War II, Russian troops, if they got wounded, they would have viruses applied to the wound, and the viruses would attack bacteria and keep them sterile. And it seemed to work pretty well. But scientists are still right now trying to find a really reliable way of doing that. And, you know, the whole concept of how to get that past the FDA, nobody knows about.
They move slowly.
They do. And how do you, like, give FDA approval to a virus? That's a tricky question.
You also wrote a book called Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea. 40% of Americans do not believe in evolution. Would that be true of Europeans? Would 40% of Europeans also say that?
No, the rates are lower in Europe.
Would 40% of people in Asia say that?
The rates are lower in Asia.
So, would 40% of people in South America say that?
I don't know about the numbers in South America. I don't. But I've seen survey data for that looks at the United States and Europe and some countries in Asia, and we rank pretty low.
So how does that make evolution an idea that has triumphed?
Well, it's become the bedrock of modern biology, whether people like it or not.
Okay. a lot of people don't believe in climate change. And yet, scientists, we're told that 95 to 99% of scientists say it's happening. When non-believers are told that, they still don't believe it. How do you deal with the fact that people refuse to believe things that don't, particularly scientifically provable things, that do not conform to preconceived notions, especially when it comes to empirical evidence? What do you do with that? Well, how do you help those people? What do you tell those people? What do you say to them?
It's definitely a challenge, and it's probably more of a challenge for, say, science teachers than it is for someone like myself. I mean, I'm really grateful for what I get to do. I go to an editor and say, "Could I write about this?" And they say, "Sure, go ahead." That's what I do.
Why don't they believe it?
Why don't they?
Yeah.
That is.
They
more,
had science teachers. Why don't they believe it?
Yeah, I mean that's got to be a question more for psychologists. I mean, how do you know the whole question of how we come to believe what we believe is a fascinating one, and then how do we hold on to those beliefs even when people challenge us on it? That's a really interesting issue, and actually there are a lot of people who are looking into that right now for these very reasons. This has real consequences. Say. When people talk about vaccines and they want to, quote unquote, protect their children by not getting them vaccinated. And what they're doing is they're putting other children at risk of dying of diseases because they're too young to get vaccinated. These have real consequences. And so, we do need to understand this better, this process of rejecting the evidence.
And is part of the reason we don't understand it is because of the woeful conditions of scientific education in America, particularly at the high school level or earlier or later? Or is it simply because we don't, as Americans, we just kind of like go with the culture and we want to know what Beyonce is doing, but we really don't want to know about genomics. We don't. You know, it's too hard.
We try to look for these easy explanations for why people don't accept different kinds of science. And most of the time, the reality doesn't fit what we want to think. So, you know, there isn't a correlation between levels of education and, say, for example, vaccine acceptance. There isn't a correlation between whether you accept vaccines and believe in global warming or not. And if you look in Europe, which has a pretty good education system, they're having lots of problems with outbreaks of preventable diseases due to people not getting their kids vaccinated. So so you can't just say, like, oh, well, people are ignorant. That's not it. It runs deeper.
But a lot of people don't. They get turned off by science. It's too challenging. It's too hard. It's too complex. It's too this. I'm looking at myself when I'm saying these things, because I was in high school. I will never forget one day when my chemistry teacher said, "Mr. Collins, you are not going to get this through osmosis." I fortunately knew what he meant, but I was lucky. It was dumb luck that I knew what osmosis was, believe me. You, however, are fascinated by this, and you write about it in an understandable way for most people, which you're opening doors for people who have been turned off by this. Do you hear from those people who have never been interested, and they read one of your books or one of your articles and go, wow?
I do sometimes, and that's got to be one of the most gratifying things about the job, or to hear from some high school kid whose eyes were opened up to something for the first time. You know, I'm not a scientist. I was an English major in college, but I was just interested in science, and I hope through what I write that I can share with people why I find some of the science so interesting.
How did you do in science?
Pretty good.
So, I mean, how did you become a science writer if you're not a scientist?
Dumb luck. No, I was looking for a job, and I was applying to some magazines just for entry-level jobs. There was a copy editing position open at Discover Magazine, and I was just a couple years out of college, and I just started copy editing there, and then they let me fact-check stories and then write little stories and write longer stories. And after a while, it dawned on me, like, this is great.
But it's so complex and prone to error. I mean, if you don't understand what you're writing about, you could really lead people down the wrong path.
It is complex, but I mean, but you know, you call up scientists, you go hang out with scientists, and just help them break it down for you. I mean, look, I mean, March Madness, you know, these brackets, they're pretty complex, you know? If you're not following college sports and you try to read articles, you'd be like, wait, who are they talking about now? How does this work? You know, but if you spend some time and work your way through it, and if someone writes about it clearly, I think people can get a good basic understanding of just about anything, not just science, but, you know, the mortgages, say. Yeah. I mean, it can be done.
You write a column every week. You write a blog a couple of times a week. You write these books. You make talks all over the country. You're doing two here today. Is there enough material? Where do you find all this material to write about on several occasions every week?
Oh.
And do the research.
Well, fortunately, science never stops. I actually remember a few years into being a science writer, I said, this is great. Like, every week I'm finding something new and exciting to write about. But what happens when they just find out everything there is to find out? I sort of had this image of basically the scientific journals just running dry. Mm-hmm. 20 years later, it shows no sign of stopping.
And you're off. There are moments of awe for you as you go through this every week. That's
Absolutely.
What keeps you going?
Sure. I mean, just one example. So scientists have been able to get ancient DNA out of fossils. And so they took a finger bone about 50,000 years old from a Siberian cave. It looked like it was human. They were able to get a whole genome out of it. And it turned out it wasn't human and it wasn't Neanderthal. It was basically another branch of humanity branched off maybe 600,000-700,000 years ago from our common ancestor. Mm-hmm. No one had ever known of this thing before. And they call it the Denisovan. And now it turns out that actually the Denisovans, who we didn't even know existed before a couple years ago, actually interbred with people in East Asia. And there are people who carry Denisovan DNA in them today. I mean, you couldn't make that up.
Speaking of DNA, Jamie emails, how far away are we from DNA computers and storage?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, so DNA, you know, it's digital in a sense. You know, it's a string of little units, and it can have one of four different units, and that's basically how we make all our genes. And it looks to be that you can kind of use that digital system kind of like a computer. I don't think that DNA computing will work particularly fast, but you could program like bacteria to do arithmetic. They've actually programmed computers to count. They put little clocks, in a sense, into bacteria. So you could actually think about, what if you could like swallow bacteria? They go into your gut, and they're sort of been programmed to release molecules at some, you know, clock-like rate. That's conceivable.
Wow. You know, given the fact that the modern world is a product of science, we're surrounded by, we're talking on things that by rights should not. This is a piece of metal. Why does this work? How can you send sound through the air with no wires? It's a miracle. Does it fascinate you that more people are not fascinated by this and interested in it and just consuming it by the bucketful?
I do actually think that people are intrigued and curious about science. I just think that people start to develop this idea that it's too complicated for them, or that it's somehow walled off from them. And I hope I can convince some people that that's not the case. I mean, that there is no, you know, high bar that you have to jump over to start learning about science. Once you start learning about it, you see how it's influencing lives all around us.
Yeah. You have this remarkable facility. We talked about this earlier, and I only have 15 seconds left, of making this understandable and easy. Is that easy for you to do?
No.
Which is why Jon Stewart lampooned you, because... because he didn't read the book.
Well, there you go.
It was too hard to read the book. That's a topic for another day, however, and we are out of time. Carl Zimmer, our guest today, science writer and author of many books about science. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte talks with Mike.